So if you could tell us when and where you were born, and then maybe we could talk a little bit about your family background.
Yeah, I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1925, January 1925, and went to school there, and grammar school, and then I went to high school also in Bridgeport, and graduated when I was 16 years old from high school, and that was ...1941, just the beginning of World War II, and I was too young to be drafted. So I went out and got a job, and the only job that I was able to fulfill at that time was to work in a machine shop. Actually as an assistant, not even an assistant, but as a guy working on the bench, filing parts that were being made to get rid of the burrs, and I would get a big box of parts and I would sit and file on them all day long and fill up another one next to me. And I did this for some time. I was working ...12 hours a day, 7 days a week, because it was right at the beginning of the war and there was a lot of defense contracts and they were busily doing stuff. So as a young 16-year-old, that's what I was doing. Didn't have a chance to have much social life. There was a guy next to me who did exactly the same thing, and we got talking one day, and he said, "I've just signed up for Bridgeport Engineering Institute, downtown Bridgeport, Connecticut, because I don't see myself doing this the rest of my life." And I said, "For God's sakes, that's right. I don't see it either." I said, "How did you sign up?" And I think I'll do it too. So he and I, with our long schedule, would leave work at 7 o'clock and then go downtown Bridgeport from 8 to 10. We would take courses, and that went on for about a year and a half. I studied physics and chemistry and metallurgy and all kinds of different things at that time. And had homework to do, so forth, and I left that job of filing parts after about a year at Bridgeport Engineering Institute, and I was then qualified to go do something more complex, which was to go to work in a microscope laboratory at the Bridgeport Brass Company, and laboratory actually did the testing of brass parts that were being made at the factory, and the hardness and the and the many properties of these parts had to be tested. As I was working there, I had a number of bosses and other people I worked with, and they kept getting drafted, and I finally ended up 17 years old now, running the lab.
Oh my goodness.
And the night shift from 11 until 7 in the morning. And there were three or four other people working with me, because this is a 24-hour-a-day thing. And I got a lot of know-how about microscopes and the way they work at that time. And I was working with a guy, one of the metallurgists, during the daytime, would come in to me and would give me samples that he wanted me to prepare for him on special things he was doing. He came in one day and he told me that there was a test being conducted at the local high school to and those who passed the test would be able to go to university and an officer's training school. It was put on by the Navy, and it was called the V-12 program. So I went to the high school, and I was about the same age as the other guys, but a couple more years experience, and I And I killed the test and ended up number one in the state of Connecticut. And so I was invited to be in the program. My mother was very pleased with that and so forth. And we had a list of universities we could select. And so I was thinking of one that was down in Maryland. And she told me in no uncertain terms, "You're going to Yale." Typical good decision by a mother. So I ended up being sent to Yale University, and I was drafted just before that time. I had just turned 18, and I got into the university just in the nick of time, or else I would have gone overseas in the Army or something. So I ended up in the Navy, and this program at Yale, and I studied mechanical engineering, and it was a accelerated program. We just went continuously. There were no holidays or vacations or anything. It was about 2.5 years I got my mechanical engineering degree at Yale. The war ended just at that time.
Mm-hmm.
February 1946, I got my degree, and I got my officer designation as ensign in the U.S. Navy. And then I spent the next 5 or 6 months traveling to Newport, Rhode Island, with some training. And that was kind of interesting in itself. And then I went to, I was assigned to the USS Cleveland, which was a light cruiser that had some serious duty in the Pacific during World War II. And we traveled around. The most interesting thing that happened during that period, 2 or 3 months, but aside from total boredom, being aboard ship and just plowing along, we ran into a hurricane in the Atlantic, and I remember the waves breaking right over the bridge of the ship, and it was quite interesting. And 99% of the people aboard, other guys who were in training such as myself, got seasick. Fortunately, I did not. I don't understand why, but I didn't. And so we went on, we ended up in Bermuda, we went to the Officers Club there, and they were selling bottles of French champagne for $1, and it was all very nice, and so I didn't have a very tough time in World War II. But in any event, we ended up going up to Canada, down the St. Lawrence River, then back out and down to New York City, where I got out. And I was assigned to the U.S. Navy Reserve with the thought that I could be called back at any time. And that was July 1946, and a month later I got a job at Chancefort Aircraft Company in Stratford, Connecticut.
Could we pause there, actually?
Sure.
Because I wanted to ask you a couple, to loop you back a little bit to a couple questions that I'm interested in. First, you mentioned your mother's good decision to send you off to Yale. Could you tell us a little bit more about her and your father, if you had any siblings?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mother and my father were involved in that decision. My mother was very strong about it. And my father was thought it was a great idea. He was a machinist in a machine shop.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of that kind of work. So he used to talk about mechanical parts, and he would tell me some things about that when I was a kid. As a matter of fact, on my shelf, take a moment here, just
sure.
This is a thing that he made at that time.
The machine.
It's a brass submarine that he made, and kind of neat. And so he was very clever.
Yeah.
I have two brothers, older brother and a younger brother, and a younger sister.
you mentioned going to grammar school and high school in Bridgeport. Were those the public schools?
Public schools, uh-huh. Right. All public schools.
Could you talk about your, you graduated high school very rapidly. Could you talk about the story behind that?
Well, my mother had put me in school when I was 4 years old in the local Catholic school. In those days, I guess they would accept young people, and I went in at 4 years old, so I went through the normal thing
right.
And graduated at 16, so 12 years.
Okay.
And what sometimes happened was that they would take these younger kids and then they wouldn't make it that first year, and then they would hold them back one more year, and then they would go on from there. Fortunately, I was able to do that. So that's basically what happened.
But you were in the Catholic school system, and then you went into the public school system?
Yes. I went into the public school in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Warren Harding High School. And that was an okay experience. I was not too motivated in high school.
Uh-huh.
But I guess I got through and graduated all right.
Did you have... in your interests and your outside activities outside of school, were you developing an interest in mechanical things, in technology or science?
Not really.
Mm.
Not that I can remember very well. I was more interested in English and English language and writing and things of that nature. So. When I got out of high school and graduated, the only job I could get and in those days was this job in the machine shop. So the Bridgeport Engineering Institute would not have occurred to me as a place to go, except for this guy I was working with who had decided that was the thing that he wanted to do, and I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. I think I want to do it too. So that's when I got my real education in science and engineering, was at the Bridgeport Engineering Institute prior to Yale. And that was a great foundation.
Hmm.
And I was just lucky enough to be at an age where I could do that. And then just as I was turning 18, I got the opportunity to go to Yale. But my knowledge of mathematics and chemistry and physics that I had learned there came in very handily at Yale. As I got into similar courses there, I was able to keep up and comprehend what was going on.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that accelerated program in mechanical engineering, the nature of your studies?
It was a canned program. The Navy wanted engineers, guys who studied engineering, and so I was told I was going to become a mechanical engineer. So I said, fine. And it was the normal first year, second year, third year, fourth year, but compressed with lots of math and, as I say, chemistry, physics. But Yale is a wonderful place because you couldn't avoid becoming educated. Because there was a lot of other courses that were taken in terms of English literature, some language stuff, and one of the other things about that university is that when you're not in school and you're having both sessions with the other guys, both sessions are about things like poetry. I remember studying T.S. Eliot very, very carefully, and we talked about it a lot. And a lot of music and stuff like that. So Yale is a wonderful place to go to school because you end up with a full-blown, complete education from one end to the other. So I was lucky enough to participate in that. But ended up doing all of the mechanical engineering courses. One of the things I was very interested in at that time was mechanical design. Mechanical engineering consists of things like thermodynamics and many other features, and that's something that you may or may not use. But and then internal combustion engines. Well, the thing that I got most attracted to was the whole concept of being able to do design work. And so I spent a lot of time studying that and working on it. So when I got out, that was the thing that I leaped into, was an area that I wanted to do. I was going to get involved with internal combustion engines or that sort of thing, or designing refrigerators. I got involved in design. That's why I took the job at Chancevoort Aircraft in Stratford, Connecticut. I worked there from 1946, August 1946, until November 1948. And that was when I look back on that 2 years, that was a pretty full thing that was going on there with me. I started off working on the board, actually doing blueprints and drawings and learning the methodologies, observing the organization in the design and drafting room. But then I got assigned to what was called the mold loft, where you actually had the shapes of the wings of airplanes, and you had to make parts that would fit that shape that had been determined by testing, aeronautical testing. And then they assigned me to the hydraulics laboratory, where I actually was assigned to testing a new generation of hydraulic parts that were going to be used in the plane we were working on, which was called the F-7U. It was a carrier-based plane, and I worked on the some of the aspects of the hook, the catch on the deck and so forth, and how to design that so it worked well. I also worked on the actual parts that were used in the hydraulic system and tested them. And the the changeover at that time was to go from a 1500 PSI hydraulic system to a 3000 PSI system, which would allow things to work more rapidly and so forth. And one of the problems with any of the hydraulic systems on the airplane was the fact that if it ever got busted during combat or something, then all of the hydraulic fluid would get pumped out, and then the plane would no longer be controllable and it would crash. So I was assigned the job of trying to figure out how to solve that problem. So I came up with a hydraulic fuse that whenever the pressure dropped at the other side of the fuse, it automatically closed down the line. And that worked pretty well. And that was my first, I guess, I don't know whether they applied for a patent on it, but it was my first real invention that I was involved with. And that was fascinating. In the October 1948 period, they announced that they were going to move the entire company, Chancevoort Aircraft, to Texas. I think Lyndon Johnson may have been involved in that decision. They took the entire company and moved it to Texas, and you've heard of Ling Temco Vought. That was the original company for Chancevoort Aircraft in Stratford. And so I did not want to go to Texas, so I started looking for another job. And I was interviewed at a small company in Glenbrook, Connecticut called the PerkinElmer Corporation. They were only, they were smaller, it was building smaller than this one, and a couple hundred people, maybe 150 people. And they had gotten involved with infrared spectroscopy either during or at the end of World War II. PerkinElmer's main interest, Richard Perkin, excuse me, was very interested in astronomy. And he worked on Wall Street, and he belonged to an amateur astronomy society that met once a month, and they would talk about telescope design and things that the people were seeing in their telescopes and photographs they were taking and talking about the thing. At that time, the whole big problem they kept talking about was the fact that they could no longer order astronomical telescope optics from Germany, where were, Zeiss and Leitz were the big producers. And they were not responding to requests. And so Dick Perkin and Charles Elmer, he was a court stenographer, by the way, decided to form a contracting company to find places in the U.S. where there were optical shops that could make such telescope optics. Turned out there was one in New Jersey, and they contracted with them to do it. And they ended up with lots of contracts from these amateur astronomers, and it became quite a successful business. And they had a very close relationship with the optical company in New Jersey, what's called Mogey and Sons, M-O-G-E-Y. And he was very knowledgeable. And when World War II came along, they answered a request for a contract to build some special optics for bomb sites. And so they contracted with Mogey and Sons to make the parts. And then they decided that the better thing to do was to merge the Mogey company with Perkin Elmer, and they moved to Glenbrook, Connecticut. And they were, during World War II, they were making these very specialized bomb site parts there. Somewhere along in there, and I don't know, I wasn't there, American Cyanamid Company in Stamford, Connecticut, which is only just a few miles away, contacted Perkin Elmer concerning manufacturing of some optics for an infrared spectrophotometer which was being designed there. And it was realized that infrared spectroscopy was a very valuable tool for chemical elucidation and chemical analyses, and so they wanted to build their own because there were just no commercial companies at that time making them. So they got the optics from Perkin Elmer and built that system, which was very large and but contained the elements of the design of the of a good system. The guys in the optical group at Perkin Elmer who worked on that told Dick Perkin that they thought this was an interesting field and one that could possibly result in something new after the war. Once bomb sites were no longer needed, there was going to have to be something. So they decided to design an infrared spectrophotometer, and there was a guy named Dick Kinnaird who was an engineer at that time at Perkin Elmer, and he actually sat down with the optical people there and designed a system which was about one quarter the size, if not less, one tenth the size maybe of the system that had been built at American Cyanamid. The physicist at American Cyanamid who they had worked with, was his name was Van Zandt Williams, Z-A-N-D-T. And he was very famous because he had published a review of all infrared spectroscopy work going back to the early part of the 20th century. And he had put down all the information about the design aspects and so forth. There's a very interesting paper that he wrote, which we used to give to customers. I don't have a copy of it. Maybe something could be looked up. It was called something like the Review of Infrared Spectroscopy or something like that by Van Zandt Williams. Dick Perkin invited him to join Perkin Elmer and to participate in taking the design that he had been involved with at Cyanamid to Perkin Elmer. And they built the first Perkin Elmer commercial product, which was called the Model 12. And It was a tabletop kind of a system. And it incorporated, because of Hallie Mogie's, the Mogie guy, Hallie Mogie, his know-how, they incorporated aspheric optics to make it more compact. So it had things like paraboloids and ellipsoids and all these kind of things instead of just strictly spherical optics. And they got excellent performance, superior to the machine that had been built at Cyanamid. And they, it was a rather crude, from the electronics point of view, it was very crude. Max Liston was at General Motors Research Laboratory, and General Motors had gotten involved in designing infrared spectrophotometers at that time. I don't know the details of that, but they actually built some. And Max Liston was involved in the building of a very sensitive infrared detector. It was a thermocouple, and he he made that work, and of course this was vitally needed by the Perkin-Elmer, new Perkin-Elmer infrared spectrometer.
Right.
So they, Dick Perkin invited Max Liston to join Perkin-Elmer and bring his detector with him. General Motors wasn't the least bit interested in going into the infrared spectroscopy field. They had built this as some kind of a thing that happened during World War II. I don't know the details. It might be interesting. Maybe Max Liston talked about that.
I think it was for some chemical production that they were actually doing at GM. So they had to...
That was it, huh?
They needed the tool, so they needed to build it. Yeah.
The way you couldn't buy one.
Yeah.
So he then transferred his electronics know-how and his and the detector to Perkin-Elmer, and then they were able to have a complete system that was able to plot infrared spectra. Model 12. What do they call it? The Model 12A or what? But then there was a Perkin-Elmer Model 12B, and then a 12C. In order to design the 12C, they attracted a guy named John U. White, Dr. John U. White, very famous spectroscopy designer, and he made some improvements to the 12B, which made it a 12C, and added for the first time a beam chopper, which chopped the beam. And this detector of Max Liston's was able to respond to that speed. Previous to that time, you measured the infrared radiation with a DC signal. And of course, the atmosphere is DC. So any temperature change that occurred to the detector, the signal would be going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And so the data from the original 12A and 12B, whatever they were called, was terrible and almost uncontrollable, and the guys who tried to plot spectra were very unhappy with the, it would take them weeks to get a spectrum. And so the chopped beam system with the fast detector that Max Liston had designed, and John White was involved with that stuff, was the first one that gave a stable, reproducible result. And that's when I appeared on the scene. I was interviewed by John White. He had started the design of the original Model 21 when he realized that the data from the Model 12C was okay, but it was also not very useful, because superimposed on all of the data was a absorption of the normal atmosphere, CO2, water vapor,
right.
anything that was in the atmosphere. And therefore the 12C was almost useless as a system for just looking in general at organic chemical compounds. It was great for quantitative analysis, which is what its main use was, that it was used in the pharmaceutical industry, it was used in the oil industry. I think John White actually came out of Exxon, Esso it was called at that time, Exxon. And he had, in the 1947 period, started to design a system which took the parts from the Model 12C and then tried to make a what was called a double beam infrared spectrophotometer. And they had a company who was in Long Island did the mechanical design, and John White received the drawings for that and then put it all together, and it didn't work.
Can we pause there? I need to flip the tape.